This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Richard Wollstonecraft, and we're going to be discussing the film High Rise. Richard, how are you doing in Melbourne? How have the fires impacted your area?
Well, you know, it's been very full on down here in Australia. I mean, we've had bushfires like the country has never seen, or maybe something like it 100 years ago or something, but it's, you know, pretty unheard of. And it seems like there's something going on, like it's somehow coordinated. Like, we've just never seen bushfires across the country, you know, right up into New South Wales and Queensland and across to Western Australia and Victoria. We've never seen anything like this in this country. And it just seems very odd that the message, you know, it's pushing is climate change at a moment when, you know, the climate change narrative seems to be faltering in a way. People seem to think it's bullshit often. We had an election here in Australia and... The Labor Party, the left-wing party, was really pushing the climate change agenda and, you know, obviously taxing the hell out of everybody. And basically the working class rejected it and voted for the Liberal Party, which is the right-wing party, like they did with Brexit and, you know, and Trump, I guess. And, you know, to me, this is something suspicious about what's going on at the moment. It just doesn't feel right. And people on the left and right feel the same way. There's just something very unusual going on.
Well, the thing about environmental issues is it is true that leftists or globalists will exploit them, but on the other hand, a lot of right-wingers will just use that as an excuse to neglect the environment.
Well, you know, I mean, this is the funny thing. I mean, you know, I'm not an anti-environmentalist. You know, I mean, I guess, I mean, I've always studied Martin Heidegger, so I'm into, like, deep ecology, and, you know, I've got an interesting book by Roger Scruton, who just recently passed away, just by my bedside on, like, you know, how... Roger Scruton, green philosophy, how to think seriously about the planet, which is like a right-wing environmentalism. You know, I think, you know, I've always been interested in environmentalism. I love that guy who's cleaning up the oceans of plastic. You know, when I travel in, you know, various countries, you know, you often go swimming at nice beaches in foreign countries, a lot of plastic everywhere. You know, that's something that's always annoyed me. And, you know, I mean, I would say that possibly the temperature is rising slightly. I really don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, it's probably conjecture.
There are glaciers and ice caps that there's already signs of melting. So that's documented.
It's happened before, though, in various periods of history. And there's a really great documentary called Climate Change Swindle. That's right. Or something like The Great Climate Change Swindle. It's made by BBC4, of all people. And basically, it's a doubting documentary. It's probably one of the best ones around. So I recommend people take a look at that. I mean, I just don't believe fully that CO2 is just the cause of it. But obviously, human beings are spoiling the planet. You have to be a complete fucking idiot. And I'm not on the side of, you know, like, what's it called, big, you know, like, companies like BP and Big Energy or whatever. You know, I'm not on the side of these companies. I'm into being all green. I'm into doing it in an affordable way and doing it in a practical way. I don't believe giving the United Nations billions of dollars from Western countries is the answer to that. Just seems like a scam. And you're quite right to point out that, you know, they do infiltrate the left side of politics to insert their agenda, and they actually also do it totally on the right. You know, you've only got to look at people like Ben Shapiro and, you know, I mean, to see that they're totally infiltrating our side of politics. And, you know, it's quite obvious the globalists have a finger in every pie as they're dialectical. I mean, that's what makes them such an interesting foe, I guess, in a way, because they constantly, you know, go into something and then steer it. For example, the right wing is often very pro-Israel at the moment, you know what I mean? Like, which is kind of odd in a way. I mean, not that I have any particular problem with Israel. I can see the argument for Israel. You know, I'm probably 50-50 either way. I can see it has problems and obviously it causes a lot of problems in the area, but what are you going to do? I mean, you can't get rid of the bloody thing, so you've got to, you know, live with it and hopefully bring about peace and stuff, but, you know, it's a very complicated situation.
And with the wildfires, I know one issue, and it's been an issue of California, is like suburban sprawl. So as urbanized areas or suburban areas spread more out into the wilderness, that increases the risk of fires. Has that been an issue in Australia?
Oh, look, there's been a number of different causes. One of the causes is that left-wing groups have stopped a thing called backburning, which is something that even the Aborigines used to do. So it's an ancient technology where you would burn a part of the bush so that if the bush catches fire, it only affects a certain part, you know, because you do the burn-off in winter or in autumn or sometime like that, when, you know, where you can control the fire, so to speak. So that could be an element that plays a part in it. Obviously, there could be some kind of temperature. There's been some odd weather where it's been particularly hot and windy on a couple of days, particularly in Melbourne, and obviously the same in New South Wales and Queensland at times. There's been reports that something like 80% of the fires are caused by arson. I mean, you know, maybe that is the cause of...
There was some arrest for arson, and there was this Muslim guy who got arrested. I know, like, some Islamic terrorist groups were threatening using wildfires as a terrorist tactic.
Yeah, no, I mean, I did a report from Tiger Mountain, which is my podcast, on, you know, I basically laid it at the door of the globalists, not saying it was necessarily directly them in a sense, but it was like their agenda. I mean, whether it be a Muslim, it could have been green activists, it could have been anybody from, you know, it could also be people being bribed. Like some of the people were like odd criminals who were like, like they worked in the fire industry, you know, maybe they're being blackmailed in a kind of Epstein way or something, you know. But who knows? I mean, you know, something weird is going on. Some of it is natural. Some of it is started by lightning. But a lot of it is being started by arson. And there's a real move. And I think there's a lot of fake news that's beginning to come out, you know. Like, there's a lot of news that it was like 80% arson. And then there were a couple of articles saying, oh, no, it's only like 1% of caused by it. That's just bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, you could see that was like the kind of thing you would see on CNN, you know. That was when the globalists move in and, you know, twist the agenda or whatever so that it becomes something different.
So the film we're going to be talking about, High Rise, I guess it does kind of tie into ecological issues, because a lot of urbanists sort of advocate this model of urbanism, like living in a self-contained city, for ecological reasons. So it is connected to ecology, and we can kind of get into that later. Just to kind of give an introduction to the film, it's by English filmmaker Ben Wheatley. And I haven't actually seen any of his other films. That's the only film I've seen. But if you want to give some kind of introduction to the filmmaker, what you know about Ben Wheatley.
Yeah, look, he's made a lot of interesting films. He's kind of been a bit of a up-and-comer in the English film industry. He made a very odd film that had a kind of almost globalist feel called Kill List in 2011. He made a film called A Field in England. He did one of the ABCs of Death. He did a film called Down Terrace. What's his new one? I'm not sure. I think his new one is one called Free Fire. Well, maybe that's already come out. But anyway, he's a very interesting up and coming guy's got to be 50. He's got to be my age. But I mean, you know, he's kind of a reasonably hot director from the UK, and he's certainly well read, and he's got his finger on the pulse. I mean, obviously adapting G.J. Ballard. I've wanted to adapt a G.J. Ballard novel, but I don't have the money to purchase the rights for many years. There's a whole stack of novels. I mean, I think G.J. Ballard's writing is particularly timely. I mean, if you want to talk about climate change, just look at Drowned World. I mean, that's exactly what it's about. He said the planet's going to overheat and we're all going to drown. I mean, you know, if the hysteria about climate change is real, Ballard already predicted it in the 60s. So this guy is a very interesting science fiction author. And he was always a strange science fiction author, because a lot of science fiction authors like Isaac Asimov, and Arthur C. Clarke, and Robert Heinlein, and many, they would often show the future spaceships, and, you know, I mean, sometimes it was dystopian, sometimes it was utopian, but it was often, you know, it was all about technology and zipping off into space and other dimensions and, you know, God knows what.
Well, what's interesting is in the film, of a 70s retro-futuristic aesthetic, but I think it does take place in the 70s, not the future, even though it's futuristic.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of Ballard's messages is the future has already happened. We're already here. We're in the future.
Yeah, so now it's the 2020s now. And I was kind of imagining, thinking about what I, back at the turn of the millennium, what I expected things to be like. And everyone on Twitter is like saying, where's our like futuristic cities?
Yeah, I mean, look, the thing that's really interesting about G.J. Ballard is that his films are always dystopian, and he often portrayed the future as very much like it is now, where something terrible goes wrong, you know what I mean? Or like some kind of human psychology becomes twisted and moves in a very strange direction or something. Like, and that actually seems to be what is happening. So in a way, he's definitely the most, what I would call visionary science fiction writer, is in the sense that he got what was actually happening. The things like technology and science, they're not good. These are bad things. I mean, obviously there's a very good side to them, let's say, so to speak. But like, there's very bad consequences of these things historically and you know, that are coming down the road for humanity. And I mean, look, if climate change is real, I mean, let's say, I mean, it's possible it is. I mean, I doubt it, but I'm not ruling it out. You know what I mean? I mean, if it is true and if it's as bad as the hystericists say it is, well, we're all fucked. Nothing Australians can do in relation to cutting CO2 is really going to help much. Maybe if you could get China and India and USA to really cut their, if it's true, cut their emissions. But like, you know what I mean? Like, this is the strange situation we're in. You know, there's a very good Jordan Peterson video on climate change I recommend you watch. You know, some woman asked him, will this be the issue that unites everybody and, you know, unites humanity? He goes, absolutely not. You know, well, he just says no, and then he goes into why. It's a very funny answer, but also quite lucid. You know, I think Ballard has had his finger on it for a long time.
Have you read the novel by Ballard?
Absolutely. I read the book probably in the 80s or the 90s. I've read a lot of G.J. Ballard. I have just about all of his books. Sometimes I find a new collected short story work that I hadn't found before. They're right by my bedside. I've got them all here looking at them right now. And, you know, I'm a huge Ballard fan, along with William Burroughs. Those research books that came out in the 80s that were published by Andrew Juno and V. Vale. Vale is a friend of mine on Facebook, and they were extremely influential. And Ballard and Burroughs were two really big influences on the work of research. And I think, you know, on the influence of culture since then, you know, both authors are kind of on the money, so to speak, you know. And I've been meaning to write an essay for the New Right, claiming that G.J. Ballard is actually an alt-right, not an alt-right, but a kind of New Right writer. He was right-wing in a way, because he often portrayed things that are going very bad, and he did not you know, propose any kind of utopian solution coming down the horizon that could be envisioned as a form of socialism, I mean, or something like that. If anything, he advocated a kind of strange kind of fascism. So he's a very interesting author. And in this book, High Rise, I mean, it takes the modern phenomenon of the you know, the tall building. You know, obviously in every metropolis around the world, there are tall buildings full of many people, and some people live in houses, and I don't know where you live or whatever. You might live in a kind of apartment block. If you do, you're in a kind of high rise. And, you know, he saw there was a kind of strange kind of potential for disaster in such a thing. Like, if society began to break down, these things would become death traps and worse, you know. And that's what this film examines.
There's this theme of class disparities, income inequality. So it's just one high rise. It's a brutalist, like 1970s style tower. They're mostly London and Britain in general has the highest concentration. There's some in the United States. Is that architecture popular in Australia?
There's a whole lot in Australia, and they're mainly full of Asian people. Asian people love them. You know, I've been to South Korea with Boyd Rice, and I mean, they're everywhere. Everyone lives in one of those kind of apartments. And obviously, in Tokyo, a lot of people live in those kind of places. Singapore and a lot of Asian places, people live in these kind of high-rise kind of nightmares. And they are kind of nightmarish. Obviously, you can live in a nice one, and there are expensive ones that are very nice, and I've had enjoyable times at people's houses in high-rises or whatever, but like, this film, you know, and book, it examines the issue of class within the context of a high-rise. Obviously, the people at the top who have the penthouses, so the kind of upper class, and then there are the kind of mid-level technocrats and middle class. That's the main character is a middle-class person. He's a kind of doctor, and, you know, they're the kind of urban professionals. One guy's an independent filmmaker. I guess he's from the upper-lower class, I guess. And he's the kind of real revolutionary or troublemaker in the film in many ways. But there's a number of them, you know. And, you know, it just examines what happens when something terrible goes wrong. And, I mean, you know, if you really look at the world around, something terrible is going wrong. I mean, look at these fires. I mean, that's a G.J. Ballard novel in itself. I mean, you know, it's extraordinary, you know. I mean, we had one near my house. I live in suburban Australia, one that was like 5 kilometres from my house. We had to go out and water the roof of my house just in case, you know, an ember got into the wind and landed near us. And, you know, I mean, you know, when you're doing that, trust me, you think, hang on a sec, maybe there's something to this, you know, climate change or something weird is going on here. You know what I mean? When it's bearing down on you. And I've known people who've lost houses and just extraordinary. So, you know, we're in a dystopian situation. That's why I think G.J. Ballard's novels are so important. And the way he predicts the collapse of civilization in many, many different ways. Obviously, he's probably going to be right on one of them, or maybe it'll be a combination of things. So that's what's so fascinating about him. So, you know, he shows with this, the book, The High Rise, you know, something that's a kind of a dream almost for many people to live in a lovely kind of high rise becomes a kind of nightmare. And it's very interesting that he chooses brutalist architecture. I've called myself a neo-brutalist at times, and there's something there with that kind of architecture that's ominous.
I can't find the exact link, but I remember there's some meme on Twitter talking about urbanism. They said that there's a very kind of honesty to brutalism as opposed to like the current kind of aesthetic of like neoliberalism or late capitalism, like the contrast between brutalism and what it represents versus the architecture, that the kind of architecture you see in a lot more in a lot of like shopping malls or corporate office campuses that are very kind of spread out and mostly glass. I mean, a lot of people hate brutalism, but it's a lot more interesting than a lot of the current corporate architecture.
I've always loved brutalism. It was obviously a movement that, an architectural movement that kind of popped up around the time of World War II and afterwards, particularly afterwards. And there's just something about it that's always fascinated me. I think because it's brutal, you know what I mean? Like, I think the future is kind of brutal in a way, and that that architecture kind of represents it. And it's kind of both beautiful and nightmarish at the same time. And I think that's part of what he's trying to get at.
Yeah, I can definitely appreciate it. I don't know if it's like as far as where you'd ideally want to live, but you can definitely appreciate it. Just go, if you're going somewhere visiting there, like if it's an office building or a hotel or a metro station, it can be very, it's very fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd want to live in a brutalist building either. I admire it as a kind of expression of, I don't know, the contemporary zeitgeist or something. I think it's a bigger idea than architecture. I've tried to even maybe expand it into politics and into film even. I mean, I could even be a brutalist kind of filmmaker in a way. There's something about it that's interesting. I can't exactly put my finger on it, but I have been collecting books on brutalism now for about 10 years. And actually, in my new film, The Debt Collector, there's about two or three buildings that are brutalist that are in the background, just because I wanted to try and shoot as many as I could that had that kind of vibe that I could find, you know, for the film. And obviously, something like Clockwork Orange used brutalist architecture. You know, the apartment block where Alex DeLarge lives is brutalist, and, you know, that kind of weird tunnel where the guy gets beaten up, the homeless guy, that's brutalist, you know. I mean, that's a statement Kubrick is making about the future. I mean, you know, that's a kind of very G.J. Ballard kind of, even though it's written by... who wrote Clockwork Orange again? I can't believe it.
I forget.
There you go. I'm glad you did too. So I don't feel like a complete idiot. But anyway, I mean, you know, so it's, you know, I mean, it's really fascinating, you know, and there's something weird going on, you know. So yeah, that had a kind of Ballard kind of feel. And
a lot of things like brutalist, the different brutalist complexes, well, obviously places in London, but I can think of places that I visited, like the, I've been in the Embarcadero Center in San Francisco. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. A lot of them do function as self-contained cities. Like, they're either connected by tunnels and sky bridges.
Sure. I mean, obviously, it's not the predominant kind of architecture. I mean, there are different kinds. It's postmodernism, but postmodernism itself sometimes has a kind of brutalist kind of feel to it. I mean, I don't know. It's just something interesting, and it's kind of popped out of nowhere, you know. And I think it reflects something deeper than just a kind of like a fashion, you know what I mean? Like oh, you know. You know, blue is in this year or something. It's way more deeper than that. Something about it.
So it's interesting how the high-rise functions. So it is basically like a self-contained city. Urbanists call it an arcology. Basically, all the amenities are within the structure. They have a school, a swimming pool, a shopping center. And I've heard they have those kind of developments in Asia. Yeah, where you can basically do everything within one structure.
You do. And, like, you know, it has everything. You know, it has everything you'd need. And, it, you know, it's quite good. It's even not bad for people, on, you know, in who are lower class in the lower floors. It's still pretty good. You know, you're in the same fucking building, really, as the architect, right? But it collapses, okay?
The film is a metaphor for societal collapse, but I don't think that model of urbanism could lead to collapse. I think if no, it it's done right. Like, I would not want to live in an exact, like, replica of the high-rise in the film, but I think you could actually borrow from a lot of those ideas and create some really, a place where there is a really high quality of life. You could have access to shopping, dining, a gym, a swimming pool within like the same structure. You can have like gardens and parks that are connected to the structure. So I think if done right, I do think it's possible to create a very high quality of life. So I wouldn't want to live an exact replica of that building, but there are structures that have those attributes. I think it's much preferable than having to drive on the freeway in traffic to, like, commute to work or to go to the market. Well, what I really was thinking a lot throughout this movie, obviously, towards the end, as a spoiler, the tower does, like, things start to break down. But I'm thinking in a lot of ways, at least in the beginning, the irony of the film is it's supposed to be a dystopian film, but in a lot of ways, like, they have a much higher quality of life than the way a lot of people live in cities and suburbs today.
Well, sure, at the beginning it does. I mean, you know, there's an interesting point in the film, and it's very important to try and note where it is. When do things go too far? I mean, because we've all been in a situation where there's been, you know, malfunctions or technology has failed or, you know what I mean? But there's a point in both the book and the film where things go too far, where things cross over from things sort of being like malfunctions with elevators and, you know, I don't know, fights between floors or people arguing to like, you know, like, you're in some other area where people are at war with each other and the police aren't coming anymore and people are jumping off buildings and the body is laying there for a week. I mean, you know, weird things like this.
Actually, interesting is there's not really that much interaction with the outside world. Basically, the entire film takes place within the high-rise.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, you know, obviously something is happening in the outside world as to why the police aren't rushing to this place. You know what I mean? Like, society itself is collapsing, and the high-rise is a kind of archetype.
Talked about this on my last show, but I do predict we'll see this in the future. As there's more decay, we're already seeing this trend in places like Brazil. As there's more decay and problems of inequality and crime, people are, especially the elites, will start to build like these self-contained cities so they can wall themselves off.
But it's important to note in the book and the film, the elite go almost first. Then, you know, the guy, the architect who lives on the top floor, he's like an arch globalist kind of figure who has strange visions, utopian visions, etc. You know, I mean, spoiler alert, well, he gets done in, you know, I mean, he's obviously kind of a villain in a way, even though he's kind of a scientific hero in some senses also. I mean, then there's all the upper class people who live on the top floors. They're a bunch of assholes who attempt to be kind of like, I guess, barbarian-like. You know, I mean, the globalists aren't going to do well if the world reverts to a kind of Mad Max situation, you know. Your right-wing survivalists with AR-15s and food hidden out in the woods, they're the kind of people who are going to do well in a kind of collapsed civilization kind of world. I mean, you know, I hope we're not heading towards that. You know, there's a possibility that we are, and there's a number of different things that can go wrong. And obviously, this film and book is about that. I mean, it's a metaphor for the collapse of civilization. You know, and in a weird way, you see the kind of Trump and Brexit phenomena arising in the kind of psychopathology of a couple of the main characters in the film. You know, let me think. Have a look. I'll get some of the names of the characters here. Let's have a look.
Richard Wilder is the filmmaker who rebels.
Yeah, I mean, you'll notice he's got the same initials as me. He's definitely the me character. He's like this rebellious filmmaker guy who, I don't know, seems to go insane. I mean, hopefully I'm not going insane, but he does in the context of the film. I mean, you know, he always has certain kind of archetypes.
No, he's not the protagonist, but you could say he's an anti-hero.
He is, you know, he's a kind of troublemaker. You know, he's somebody who I don't want to use the metaphor like fire starter, but you know what I mean? Like someone who, propagates a situation. You know, he leads a group of people down to the pool, a bunch of kids who the upper class hate, and, you know, and ruins their kind of, you know, what's it called? Hors d'oeuvres party. And he just begins to kind of like, you know, create the kind of warfare between the floors because he thinks it's interesting. And then he becomes like a wild person. Obviously his name's Wild, but it's obviously meant to be name as destiny. So, you know, he becomes a kind of, you know, almost like a post-apocalyptic kind of figure. And obviously it leads to his own destruction. And this, you know, brings out a kind of Dr. Hyde version of himself.
The film is about class disparities and income inequality, but I'm thinking about the degree of income inequality and what happens in cities and what urbanists advocate. Because if you think about, I'm basically near LA and I'm thinking about the degree of income inequality, the way things are now. So you'll have these like $50 million mega mansions that are totally gated off in the, up in the hills in Bel Air. Then you'll have like these.
Now the rich feel.
Then you'll have yeah, but then you'll have like these vast areas of ghetto and these homeless encampments. Right. Then you'll have more poor people living out in the desert. Well, if you look in this film, The High Rise, like basically these people basically all live in the same tower, and a lot of urbanists, like left leaning urbanists, will actually advocate that, like having people of different classes live in the same building as a way to ease inequality. So I would kind of think of the film is the degree of inequality, even though it's supposed to be a dystopian film, is much less so in like a modern city like LA or London or New York.
Sure. But the important thing about High Rise is the people at the bottom, the middle class, or the lower middle class and the lower class, they're going to the top and they're not making it better. They're destroying everything. I mean, and that's what it's about. I mean, you know, it's about the collapse. And, you know, I would say our society is in a kind of collapse. People in Beverly Hills and, I mean, in Malibu, for example, people felt very safe and everything. But then there were these incredible fires rushing through there. I mean, that wasn't exactly too safe now, was it? So people are definitely not safe. And, you know, I think that Ballard portrays communism as a kind of nightmare. He portrays the left as a kind of nightmare. And he's not particularly fond of the right. But he does seem to show that that has the kind of strength, you know, in the sense that, like, that will prevail, you know, in the sense it's stronger. And I agree with that. And that's one of the reasons I am a right-winger, because it will prevail, because it's more brutal, it's more brutalist. And, I mean, one of the interesting things about science and technology, that everybody who advocates it, which is almost everybody on the global world stage, is that it exasperates inequality and exasperates inequity and financial inequity. So it's making the situation worse. I mean, since the Berlin Wall collapsed, you would think the world could have become more financially equitable, which the exact opposite has happened. So, you know, the mega rich have taken everything. And, I mean, they think that makes them feel safe. No, no, that just makes them the easiest target on earth for any serious revolutionary party, whether it be of the left or right. I mean, there's a kind of right-wing socialism that's been mixed into the new right. You could seize the assets, nationalize things like Facebook, nationalize Google. I mean, you know, something like Gilead in The Handmaid's Tale I find fascinating, because it could happen. Not like it is shown in that show. I mean, it wouldn't be like this weird thing with these women and the infertility thing, even though there is a kind of infertility crisis or whatever. But something like a right-wing conservative Christian revolution in America is extremely possible within the next 2 or 3 years, 5 years.
And especially taking into account, like, inequality is going to get dramatically worse with this next wave of automation that Yang's been talking about.
It's the direct fault of the upper class, who have basically stolen everything. The globalist elite, they've stolen everything, and they think they're safe. No, they've just amassed it all. They've amassed everything for us to come and get it. And guess what? We're coming to fucking get it. You know, they think they're fucking smart. They're dumb. You know, I mean, if they were smart, they would have made financial inequity, you know, which they could definitely do, they could alleviate it, but they've made it worse, they've exasperated the situation, they've created a situation where either the far left or the far right are going to seize power in various countries around the world, and it's already happened. I mean, if you look at the UK and if you look at the USA, they're the two major Western countries. You have an almost, Trump's not exactly a right-wing socialist, but he's definitely a new right-wing populist. He's definitely not the kind of politics we've seen over the last 25 years. And Brexit as well. They're both nationalists. There's been a huge return to nationalism, which has seized the two major countries in Western civilization. I mean, this is not like a conspiracy theory. It's the news. And everybody's upset about it, but like it's happened. And it'll keep on happening because it's popular, you know, like because it's better than what we're being offered at the moment, which is crumbs from the table of vicious plutocratic bastards.
There's nationalism and right-wing populism or right-wing socialism. What are your thoughts on... We've talked about this in past shows, but what are your thoughts on Bernie Sanders?
I like Bernie Sanders. I like Jeremy Corbyn. You know, it's very interesting the way Jeremy Corbyn was kind of sabotaged by the Israel lobby. And, you know, I mean, like, don't think left-wing people don't notice that. You know what I mean? The amount of left-wing people who are fond of my politics would blow your mind, okay? I'm just going to tell you that. So, you know, things are very, very dangerous right now. You know, The left itself is kind of a shipwreck. I mean, obviously, the actual politics is all to do with, like, you know, refugees and open borders and LGBT agendas and stuff. But this is not in Marx. It's not the old left. It's not to do with unions. It's not to do with helping the working class. It's not really the left most people are familiar with. Both Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders are the old left to some extent. Both of them also have a finger in the globalist pie because everyone has to. Even Trump has a finger in the globalist pie because he has to with all this Iran bullshit. So, you know, I mean, it's fascinating what's going on, but I'm fond of both of them. And I don't think Bernie Sanders will get up. I do predict Trump for 2020, and I support it. But I think right now Trump is being blackmailed because the globalists have assets within the GOP. And what's it called? The House has not sent the impeachment bill to the Senate so they can vote on it. So they're using this stopgap to kind of force Trump to do some things in relation to Iran. I mean, you know, if you want foreign interference in our elections, there it is. It's quite obviously they're blackmailing him to do this. I mean, maybe getting rid of that Iranian general is a good idea. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm a friend of Alexander Dugin, who's a Russian kind of new right thinker. He was very much against it. He's on, you know, and he's very anti-Israel from a right-wing perspective and stuff. So, you know, I mean, it's a very complex ball of wax. You know, I think it's a very dangerous, again, a dangerous situation. And people can see what's going on. I mean, you know, it's always the same group of people. And, you know, that's it.
What's interesting about the film is that it's basically almost entirely homogenous. So basically all the characters in the film are white English people. The theme of diversity is not an issue.
No, it isn't in a way. And in a sense, it isn't. I mean, oddly enough, a lot of foreigners, I did a report on this I did a report from Tiger Mountain on two allies the New Right didn't realize they had. And they were women. Women are basically conservative. I've always believed that. Obviously, sometimes they subscribe to this left-wing feminism. Some of them do anyway. But all beautiful women are always attracted to kind of aggressive right-wing dominant alpha male types, whether it be in literature or in real life. I mean, that's everywhere. The left-wing like to scream and yell, that's not true. But obviously, they don't know anything about women. And then foreigners themselves, I mean, I won't say refugees, but foreigners are deeply conservative. Take the Muslim community, way more conservative than the alt-right on just about everything. You know what I mean? I had a chat to a Muslim guy who worked in a shop here about politics and things. You know, we have a kind of right-wing nationalist figure called Pauline Hanson. And I said, are you worried about her? And he said, no. And he said, actually, she's great. He said, you know what she's doing? She's just standing up for your people. And I thought about it. I said, you know what? She is, isn't she? Yes, of course. We think we're stupid. We realize what she's doing. She said, but listen, I come from Pakistan, the country I came from, and the Taliban was a legitimate party where I came from. You could vote for it on the ballot. So there's no one on the ballot in Western civilization that we're worried about yet. You know, so even like people like Trump and Brexit, they're not worried about things like this. You know, I mean, there's no direct threat so far, at least anyway, to I guess what you call the Muslim diaspora in Western civilization. Obviously, there's a kind of general mood. There's a kind of odd mood at the moment. You know, is this artificial? Is this being created? Is this deliberate? This kind of, you know, there's a kind of feeling of the West versus Islam. I mean, sometimes I buy into it. I mean, obviously, I'm against Islamic immigration, but one of the reasons I'm against it is because I actually do like Muslim and Arab people. I think it's a dangerous time to come to the West. You know, we say, I'll come to our countries, but, you know, what's going to happen to our countries? If they turn out like a G.J. Ballard novel, believe me, they don't want to fucking be here. I'm thinking of them, you know?
What's interesting with this film, like, kind of comparing it to other dystopian films, so we discussed The Joker, and The Joker's probably one of the best dystopian films. I'm not sure if you're picking up on this, but I just find so many ironies that their quality of life is, like, much higher than what a lot of people experience today. So, like, you see in The Joker...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'll give you one example. Like, in the film The Joker, like, the character, the Joaquin Phoenix's character, Arthur Fleck, is basically totally alienated and atomized. And you see him, like, riding alone on the bus with, like, violent criminals. And in this film, The High Rise, a lot of the people have a pretty high quality of life. But they do touch on a little bit on the theme of social atomization. But I would say that the people who live in the high rise, they're probably more connected to each other in comparison to the way a lot of urban life is today.
You know, I mean, you know, the different kinds of films, in a way, The Joker is about, you know, how somebody who seemingly has good intentions or is a reasonably good person who was only perhaps, you know, kind of fighting in self-defense when he's attacked on the train. You know, when he fights back against those people and shoots them, who are the kind of yuppie kind of, I don't know what they're meant to be. They're almost meant to be like Trump supporters in a way, yuppie globalist, maybe, I don't know. The thing that was interesting about Joker is that you went along with the narrative, and you know, you were pretty much sympathetic to him right to when he basically pulls a gun out and blows out Robert De Niro's brain on television, which everyone basically cheers in the audience. You know what I mean? Like, you know, so, you know, I mean, now, I mean, it's a different kind of dystopia to the one portrayed in High Rise, which is a kind of, it's a metaphor, again, for the whole of civilization. And, you know, if you know the work of G.J. Ballard, as I do.
The thing about it is about, like, a metaphor for civilization is I don't really think it really captures globalism because, it doesn't really capture globalism because of...
The globalist is the scientific guru, the kind of Apple guy, the architect, you know? That's the guy on top. And then they're kind of aristocrats who surround him and everything, and they all feel wonderfully safe. But when it comes to a fight, they're not ready.
Kind of the contrast, like the comparison of like the architect character to the globalist elite. So what I was thinking about the architect character is that he's someone who's actually an innovator, a visionary. So he's basically building this place. He contributes to scientific and aesthetic architectural innovation. So I don't totally see him as a villain because he's actually building stuff. I mean, one of the key issues with our current elites is that they're not really visionaries. A lot of them are just kind of managerial types. A lot of the people who run the corporations and tech companies and politicians are managerial types who just basically kind of manage. They manage the decline and extract resources. Kind of respect him because he's actually a visionary. He's an innovator. I like the whole penthouse setup he has. So I think he is too positive to compare to like the current managerial elites.
No. I mean, he's the villain, though. He's the architect of the destruction in the film. You know, he creates a situation that turns into a nightmare. But he meant the best intentions. He meant to create a utopia. But he created a complete nightmare. And I think, in a sense, I mean, I don't think the globalists are deliberately trying to destroy the world. You know what I mean? Like, are they stupid? You know what I mean? Because I think the first people they'll destroy will be themselves. And that's exactly what happens in High Rise. They're the first to go. The elite, you know, you can't hide behind your electric fences forever, man. With your fucking gold and your money and your bank accounts, you know, any kind of serious left or right revolution will sweep you away in a fucking weekend. You know what I mean? And things are getting, you know, I mean, you just see what's going on. I mean, you know, you're seeing Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. They're actually serious socialist candidates, and they have a chance of winning.
I mean, it was interesting you meant what you were saying earlier, because this conservative guy, James O'Keefe, he leaked out this thing of one of Bernie Sanders' staffers talking about, like, rounding up billionaires, confiscating wealth, and putting them into gulags. And a lot of mainstream conservatives were appalled by that.
I would say to the capitalists and the globalists, get with the new right, get with us, because we're less radical than the socialists and the true left, the old left. I mean, you know, in a sense, right-wing capitalism, you know, really keeps capitalism. It kind of just makes it have a kind of more nationalist ennui. But, you know, if you look at even, like, fascist regimes...
Yeah, because the thing is, like, I mean, I do think there is a danger that socialism could be taken, like, too far. But with, like, nationalist economics, there's more of a balance between a moderate version of socialism with some free markets.
I mean, I'm a real believer that we need to study from the past. And right now, because we are in a dangerous period, we must not replicate the dangerous side of the far right and the dangerous side of the far left, which is obviously with the far left, it's communism and all that nonsense to do with Stalin and Mao and Pol Pot and all that hideousness. And with the right, nationalist right, it's the extreme radical nationalist right, which is Nazism. So we need to avoid those two radical ends. So we need to avoid gulagging. Maybe we want to, you know, seize their assets, but I don't know. Maybe we can do it in a way like, yeah, here's $100 million or $10 million and, you know, fuck off and go do something else. You know, I mean, let them move to Switzerland or somewhere where it's safe or whatever and do something new. Maybe they need to do something new because many of these things like, you know, Google and Facebook and Twitter and everything, these could be totally nationalized as public utilities, and I believe they should be. And of course, that's really radical to say that. But
yeah, I agree. I mean, that makes total sense. What's interesting because with the architect as this kind of utopian visionary, this is where I disagree with a lot of like conspiracy theorists and some people on the distant right. Is a lot of them, they see the globalist elites as overtly utopian. Well, I don't really see it that way. I think the problem is more, like, you have people who are just concerned for, like, the short-term profit, who want to basically manage the decline, and then you have all the kind of woke stuff added on, like woke capital. But I don't think utopianism is a problem. I think the problem with society is that there's no grand aesthetic or utopian visions. I think we need a lot of that stuff, and I think our elites are failures because they lack that, not because they are utopian.
But you are right that, for example, the architect in the film, he's a visionary guy and he's a good guy. He's fascinating. He's super intelligent. He's kind of Nietzschean. There's a lot of things I admire about him, but he's the architect of the destruction in the film, in a way he's the villain. Now, there are many people like that. For example, Steve Jobs is an amazing genius who did amazing things. But, like Ricky Gervais said at the opening night of Golden Globes, you'll say you're woke, but, you work for Apple and Amazon and Disney and,
It goes back to what you were saying is Ricky Gervais is he's actually like an authentic leftist, but these woke idiots were actually saying that, oh, you're giving out conservative talking points.
Let me tell you what's happening right now. Left-wing ideas are infiltrating the right, and right-wing ideas are infiltrating the left, which is even more dangerous than the previous thing. So, this is a very interesting situation. In a way, it's what Marine Le Pen said. It's nationalists versus the globalists. And the globalists don't have the numbers, And I don't know. They have this idea of a new world order or some kind of global hegemony run for the United Nations. Trump's already cutting the funding off to the United Nations. It's already being sabotaged in various different ways from various different countries around the world. Australia's ignoring it. Britain's going to do the same. These are architecture the globalists have set up, like the United Nations, and people like Soros think, I don't know what they think they're going to do. It ain't going to fucking happen. You know what I mean? It isn't going to happen. Something else is going to happen. And, they're the architect of their own destruction. It's exactly what Heidegger said about them, which is Selbstvernichtung. They are self-destructive. They are the apex of destructiveness. The apex of destructiveness destroys itself. But many of them are good people. Many of them are visionary. You're right. They want to have a good time. Many of them having a quite good time. It's, they're decent people. They've done well because they had great ideas. Some of them are evil, running around with Jeffrey Epstein and God knows what. And, and this is all broken so wide that everybody knows what's going on now, that our politicians are blackmailed through systems like that. And, that's why you're seeing these Iran attacks and all this nonsense.
Do you have any thoughts on the later, we talked about the first half of the film, like the later half of the film where there's this massive breakdown in infrastructure, and then there's a suicide, and then the murder of the architect.
Well, it's very interesting. That's why I said it's very important to note in the film, when does it reach the point where things go too far? There are things like elevator breakdowns. There are things like, intercom systems not working. There are things like, the supermarket running out of food. These things happen in our countries now, right? In different ways, in different kind of meta ways, right? And, there's a point at which it goes too far and you've crossed over into somewhere else. And that is the danger, because that's where we are right now. We're near something like that. And when you cross over, you won't know it. It'll just happen. And you'll think you're still in the other world, but you're in a new one. And, things like these bushfires. And, if the Iran war were to kick off and it were to go into some kind of World War III type situation, this is a nightmare for everybody, including Iran, including Israel, including the United States. Whoever wants to start that is a fucking maniac.
I guess that is a theme of the film. The technology got too complicated. That's what caused things to break down.
Yeah, it's like a system. It's a system that's been established, an architecture in a way, a kind of matrix, right? And there is a globalist matrix, whatever you want to call it, around the world, and it's collapsing. There's already movements, strong movements from it on the left and the right. And these are the groups that can actually create something like a new world order the left is possible of it, I guess, with some kind of global communist thing. Maybe the globalists are backing that. There's accusations that they are. But I believe that it's the right that has they're the true, I don't know what you would call world dominators. If you want to actually have something like a new world order, well, you should talk to us. We would actually do it. Or we could do it. Though I don't think you should do it the way the globalists want to do it or whatever. I spoke about elite replacement theory and stuff. And, you must, once you begin to get into these huge geopolitical issues, power goes to your head.
If we talk about elite replacement theory, the key issue is actually empowering more visionary, so empowering people instead of having just a bunch of managerial type intellectuals, artists, architects, and scientific innovation is important as well, like people who actually create stuff of value.
No, I mean, look, you know, I'm very anti-globalist. You would note that from my page and everything. But, you know, I mean, I got two books by George Soros the other day because I want to read. I want to see what he actually thinks. I mean, does he actually have some kind of cohesive theory or ideas or something? And, like, I think we need to talk to the globalists because, I mean, to save them in a way, you know what I mean? Like, because in a sense, they do occupy kind of a level of society we don't want to see immediately destroyed.
You can make these metaphors for globalism. The global system, like a super state like the United States, is so massive. The unit of the high rise is actually it's fairly contained, so you might have 10,000 people in one structure. So I kind of coined this phrase, I call it vertical nationalism. You build up your own tribe and you get together people who have things in common, like some kind of cohesive identity. With the high rise in the film, even though with like the class divides, it is like basically demographically and culturally fairly homogenous in this one kind of contained structure. So 10,000, maybe 5 to 10,000 people who are similar, exactly, living together, sharing space. So I don't really like, it's to me, the film that class, really right? Isn't like that really isn't globalism, even with like all the problems that happen. So say you were to build one of these like self-contained cities, it could function as a mini, kind of like a mini city state where you would bring together people who either are similar demographically or just have like shared interest and build a cohesive community like that, because it's sort of like a more forward-thinking, futuristic way at achieving some of these goals, but there, it could be done within a major urban area. I call it, like, I've coined it, like, as a vertical nationalism.
All right, not a racial one. It's really a class one to do with economics.
The other is a class divide.
Right? It's kind of Marxist in a way. But what happens? Things don't end up into some kind of socialist utopia. Everything fucking collapses in a nightmare. People start eating dogs. I mean, this happens in Venezuela and many failed, socialist communist countries. So it's definitely not pro-socialist. It's definitely not pro-communist. In a way, if anything, pro-new right. Because it's saying now's the time to go and have a meeting with the architect, the middle class, and the aristocrats, and the doctor, and maybe the filmmaker, Richard Wilder, who's basically me, you know, in a way, and like say, let's fix the elevator, let's get the supermarket stocked with food, and let's not head down this path to disaster, because it could be avoided at any time, and that's what we need to do. So why I appear often anti-globalist, I really just want to open a dialogue. I mean, I want an invite to Davos. I mean, seriously. You know, I should be at these conferences talking on the new writer.
As the filmmaker, there is an element to him. He does just want to create chaos. He has a kind of anarchist streak. There's also where he's being kind of kept out and he's not being given a voice in the stake of things. But the kind of question is, like, some people will advocate everyone. But the thing is, it's not practical. Like, not everyone in society is going to have an equal voice. Obviously, the inequality that we have.
We need to accept inequality. I mean, because there's just no way you can fix it at the moment.
You're not going to have equality. The better solution is getting like the right people in leadership positions. Elite replacement theory is a solution.
Yeah. Sure, exactly. That's what I've been saying. And like, the globalists are a group of people that totally are into inequality, in the sense that, like, they are obviously financially unequal to most other people on the planet. You know, they're incredibly, some of them anyway, are incredibly wealthy and mega rich and plutocratic, etc. But, like, I mean, this is why it's, and it's interesting the way that race was not an element in the high rise. So can you imagine if you did add to the high rise, and then that would that would burn everything down quicker, or like blow everything up quicker. And you're right about the Richard Wilder character. He does have an anarchist streak. And I will admit, some very astute friends of mine have said, you're a bit of an anarchist, aren't you, really? You know, and I won't deny that I have a slight anarchist streak to me, but I'm not interested in tearing everything down. I'm interested in, shaking things up then to achieve positive change. I don't wish to tear everything down. I don't wish to tear the globalists down. I don't wish to tear the current system down. I wish to ameliorate it, to alter it, make it so it can at least run for another 20 or 30 years without something horrible like what happened in the 20th century happening. You know, because the globalists aren't listening. They're running down the same bullshit. They're pushing the same crap. I do believe that the globalist system, the neoliberal order that we've lived under since, the fall of the Berlin Wall, is collapsing, or, you know, maybe has already collapsed. Have we already crossed over? Because I think we have. And that we're heading towards something else. And what is it? Because, you know, one minute you're where you are, and next minute you're somewhere completely different. And you just look at history to see it happens all the time. And so that's what I think High Rise is about. Though it betrays it is a collapse, it's a kind of Mad Max kind of experience. And that's, of course, a possibility as well.
We're close to the end of the show. Richard, is there anything else you want to add about High Rise?
You know, I just think it's really interesting. And, you know, I mean, if you look at the last series of novels by G.J. Ballard, that started with the book Cocaine Nights and went up to Kingdom Come, that dealt with a kind of upper middle class elite that kind of almost becomes like fascist or becomes like anarchistic, like the Joker even, some kind of mixture of the two. And his last five novels were all on the same theme. I think that was his final conclusion. I would like to make one of those books into a film, like Supercan is one of my favorites, and the novel Kingdom Come about a mall, where a kind of right-wing nationalist revolution comes out of a mall. I thought this was really, really spot on to exactly what is happening in our society, oddly enough. So, you know, I think Ballard is extremely timely. His portrait of decay is true, but he's written it for a reason, to warn us. We can turn away from all these disasters. And it's time to do it. It's time to talk to the globalists. It's time to talk to the various parties, talk to the Muslims, talk to Israel. And it's just start calming shit down, mate. The things aren't going well. And I think it's best for everybody if we do that, right? You know, so that's my, I guess, mature opinion. And I also think it's about psychology. It's not just about class and economics. You know, it's about some kind of psychological shift, almost a benevolent psychopathology that Ballard talks about, that's in a book like Crash, that people's minds are changing by technology, and we don't know where that's going. So it's very interesting and also maybe challenging and dangerous. So, you know, there it is. That's my thoughts on all that. And it's great talking to you, Robert.
Richard Wollstonecraft, thanks for being on. And everyone, I'd recommend checking out High Rise.
I agree. Great, always great talking to you, mate. And you're a very good interlocutor. Is that the word? Or debater? Thank you.